The committee will come to order. Members, please take your seats. Representative Marquardt, we do not have a quorum, but would you like to talk about your bill?
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members. House File 1222, for some members who have been on the Tax Committee or the Property Tax Division of Tax, have seen this a few times. But this is a bill that tries to add a little more accountability to the truth and taxation process. And the pages are passing out some forms that you all are familiar with. But one is the actual truth and taxation statement that you receive in mid-November. And then the other thing you're seeing there is the advertisement that each entity must post in the newspaper, talking about what will be the increase and so forth. The actual hearings for truth and taxation process for local units of government, you don't necessarily have to have those meetings unless your levy goes over a certain percentage, which is the implicit price deflator. And Ms. Baker says for this year, that would be basically 4.285% increase, and you would have to have these meetings. But what this bill does is really centers around Section 4, the heart of it, and then all the other timelines are adjusted so that we can get to this one part. And so everything has to be moved up. And the one part that what I really want to change is the notice of the proposed property taxes. And if you go to the back of this sheet right here, which is the bill summary, it's got the timeline, but the one I'm really focused on is the notice of proposed property tax levy. Currently, the current dates are those go out between November 10th and November 24th. And that's going to be the statement that tells you how much your property taxes are going to go up in each of your local jurisdictions. What I would like to do is move that up basically about a month and have that come out October 15th to October 24th. Of course, the idea then is to place it before any elections. Now, not everyone's going to have an election every year, of course. You know, if it's a county, it'd be primarily an even number of years. School districts are every year depending, and city councils, out of about the 854 cities, about an eighth of them have their elections on odd years, including Representative Lanning's and my cities of Moorhead and Dilworth still have theirs on the odd year, but only about an eighth of the cities. And of course, legislators on even numbered years. So the idea here is to increase the accountability, and I think the discussion on property taxes would be a little more urgent, a little more intense, a little more relevant if they came before the election date. Now, this isn't just to hold local government officials' feet to the fire, for example, and they to feel the pressure. This would also, I think, look at legislators. Because as you would talk about property taxes, the whole scheme of things as far as why property taxes are going up would certainly focus on legislators also. So this is an attempt to make things more accountable, make property taxes maybe focus a little more of the debate, which is before an election. And as I was doing some research and talking to a county commissioner who dealt with this when this was, he was in the legislature when this was being dealt with, he said, in fact, one of the reasons the date of this is after is November 10th and 24th was to make it after the election. So there actually was an intent to do that. And in fact, he said legislators were concerned about that. Wasn't putting more pressure on local officials, but also legislators were concerned about placing it beforehand. But I think just that being said means that if we can move it up ahead, that you might have a better debate and more citizen involvement in this truth in taxation and property taxes. Madam Chair, I know there's some opposition. And so I don't know if we take questions now and then hear opposition, or I don't have anyone in support, at least not that I know of, planned of this bill. But of course,
Representative Marquardt.
Yes, Madam.
You have quorum now. Would you like to move your bill?
I will move my bill for possible House File 1222 for possible inclusion into a possible property tax omnibus bill.
Thank you. Let's take questions. Representative Temer.
I don't think this is such a bad idea, actually. I think shining light on it. The only concern I would have is knee-jerk reaction. You know, we like elections to be thoughtful. We like people to have contemplated, you know, who they want to vote for based on things that we talk about during elections, things that local officials talk about during. I guess the only concern I would have, I like the idea that early people can see right away what their local officials have done with property taxes. As we know, property taxes are levied by local officials, not by state officials, other than the businesses and rec, of course, that's levied by the state. You know, it does open up the possibility for electioneering for people claiming that they have something to do with property taxes when they're really leveled locally, and it's a concern that we have sometimes that there's this this impression put out by people as to where the taxes come from, and you know, it's interesting that they would still not know that. But I like the idea of having it early for accountability, and I think that makes some sense. I do have some concern about electioneering and positioning and a knee-jerk reaction, and maybe having short-term emotional decisions made at an important election time. So I think that's our debate, and I don't know if you have any thoughts about that. Obviously, you've probably put some thought into it yourself, and I'd be interested in what the testifiers have to say about that.
Yeah. Madam Chair and Representative Denver, it certainly could be an October surprise when it comes to elections. You know, it would be a couple of weeks right before an election, and certainly those running, I presume especially, those challengers could use it in some way, shape, or form. But I do think also it would get legislators involved, because there's things the state does, of course, in policy that can affect property taxes. But I think the bottom line still, it would focus, I certainly think you'd have property taxes as part of the dialogue during that election campaign, which I think would be a good thing. Not that there's any excuse why it shouldn't be at this point, but right now before elections, even though a citizen can go to their September meetings, and I'm sure the newspaper is going to, you know, if they have an article on what the levy's going up, but that's not quite as good as actually getting that form in front of you ahead of time and taking a look at it. But, of course, Madam Chair, the fact that you have to move everything a month scrunches things up a little. We moved it back, and so that's going to have some concerns for counties and school districts, probably more so than anything. So unless there's other questions,
there are. Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That was going to be my question here. I would, part of the proposal here is not to change the mid-September date in terms of certifying the levy. That means that there's going to be basically a month between the time that local units of government have to indicate what their maximum levy would be and the time that the county has to the time that the county has to get these out. And I really question whether that doesn't put a lot of counties in a real bind, being able to get these turned around and out in less than a month. I think you have an idea that certainly is worth consideration, but I have a concern about the practical ability of counties to be able to do this in that short time frame.
Madam Chair, Representative Lanning, exactly as staff and I and research put this together, that was probably the biggest concern. And the notice of proposed property taxes has moved up about 26 days, and we do move up the proposed levies about 14 days from September 15th to September 1st. So you're crunching the schedule, at least between the time between the proposed levy and the notice, you're crunching it about 12 days, I suppose. So it does create a little narrow of a window.
Thank you. We've got one more question, and we'll take some I'm sorry, Cliff Van Lanning.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I didn't catch the moving up to September 1st. And I know in my experience as a local official, you're hard-pressed to meet that September 15th deadline, especially when you're dealing with activities of summer vacations and whatnot, and getting your budget all put together. So that would still be a concern.
Representative McCourt? Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Marford. I actually don't have any problems with it being more accountable during the elections, you know, and getting more discussion of that at the doorstep. My concern is, having worked at the state and the city and tangentially at the county on budget development, to me, that's actually the bigger concern. And if, I assume we'll hear from some local government people, but that's my concern about having to have a proposed levy by September 15th. When so much of what local government does is in partnership with the state government, we get, you know, our budget done at the end of May. Things are effective July 1st, August 1st. You don't have any real experience. More importantly, for some of the programs like in human services or corrections where you have actually state agencies, the legislature gives sort of a general framework and then the state agencies create all the program requirements and stuff. You really don't even have that direction till pretty late in the summer. And so I'm just a little worried about the budget development part of it in terms of who has to figure that all out and put together some realistic numbers. And it might force us to do our budget work earlier. I'm not sure that could be another solution. I wouldn't mind having some of May off, but I think we need to just think through that practical end of it as well.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler. That's a good point. And, you know, already, you know, you're having to come up with a budget for the next year by September 15th, which means you started working on it in May or June, probably, like you're saying. So you're trying to, so longer would be the better. But, you know, I think there would, you know, there'd certainly be some weaknesses here in doing that. But I think in terms of the accountability gain that you might have to try to, you know, make it work on the other end would be worthwhile. Madam Chair, I know Mr. Melcher from Department of Education, and I think there are others. So
thank you.
Have concerns.
Welcome.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. My name is Tom Melcher, and I'm the Finance Director at the Department of Education. The department has concerns about the earlier date for levy certification for school districts. Currently, the proposed levy is certified on September 30th. This would move that up 30 days to September 1st. Under current law, the Department of Education is required to certify the levy limits for school districts to the school districts by September 8th. This doesn't change that date, but we presume that that would need to be changed and that we would need to certify the levy limits to the school districts in early August. Currently, the department is hard-pressed to get the levy limitation information out to the school districts by early September. We have a very complicated levy system for school districts. We have about 50 different school district levy categories. Each summer, after the close of the legislative session, I have staff that are working overtime throughout the summer to basically interpret what's in the law, figure out what new data we need to collect from the school districts, get information out to the school districts. We like to give the school districts 30 days to turn around their report so that they have time to provide us with accurate information. And then we need to reprogram a very complicated set of calculations to the school districts. And so we're pretty hard-pressed just to get that out to the school districts in an accurate fashion by early September. And then the school districts are making numerous changes during the month of September to the initial reports that we send out. Quite often school districts find that for example, estimates of pupil units, numbers of students change. When the kids show up to school on the 1st of September, those estimates they gave us during the summer may not be so accurate. And so they're trying to get the levy calculations as accurate as possible. In fact, we've had pressure from the Rochester School District, among others, in recent years to move the date back. And in fact, they did get the date moved back so that they can go into early October to certify that because they feel like they can get a much better figure in terms of what their property tax levies will be. So we have no objection in terms of the policy that Representative Marquardt is trying to move forward here. We just feel like we can't honestly guarantee that the department can produce accurate information for the school districts to certify their levies on if the date was moved up a month.
Do we have other testifiers from the audience? Good morning, and you'll say your name for the tape.
Madam Chair, members, I'm Keith Carlson. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Intercounty Association, and I frankly want to speak to basically the same issues that Mr. Melcher spoke to, but from the county or property tax administrator's perspective. First, before I do that, I do want to acknowledge the good intentions of the Representative's bill. We're certainly not against this information being out as early as possible, but I would like to suggest to the committee that local elected officials' roles in setting the property tax, that information is already available before the election every year. Their role in setting property taxes is determined at the time that they adopt their levies, or at least their preliminary levies. And that is, information is available publicly right now by September 15th for the non-school local government and by September 30th for the school local government. And I'm sure many of you are familiar with those newspaper stories that come out at the time that those levies are adopted at the open meetings of the city councils, the county boards, and the school boards, and so on. In terms of the taxpayers being aware of the budget and spending and levy decisions, the information is there right now. It's not there right now is the exact impact on individual properties. Now getting to my primary concern, which basically parallels that of Mr. Melcher, is the practicality of this proposal simply is not there. Each year a process starts that ends, begins with the end of your legislative session, because once you have established the policies with regards to the property tax system, the various state aids, process is initiated at both the local and state level. Mr. Melcher has acquainted you with that at the Department of Education, but similar processes occur in other agencies, particularly the Department of Revenue. At the same time, those processes are going on at the local level. The key one is reprogramming our computers to account for the law changes that occur in the property tax system practically every year. The tax bill that was just passed by both bodies will require such reprogramming, and that is not simply a matter of pushing a few buttons. Most of the counties belong to one of three major computer consortiums. They contract with third-party vendors. Those vendors literally take a month. They do a very good job, but it takes them practically all summer to reprogram or write the software that will ultimately just be installed on each of the 87 counties' individual computers for operating the system. Once that software is installed, on each of those 87 computer systems, they have to be tested to make sure that it operates properly. I then handed out the document that goes through some of the key dates in what actually happens after the computer systems are up and running and ready to administer the new property tax system. And you'll see many of the dates that were summarized towards the bottom half of this and the changes that are proposed there. But if you look at the top of the table, these are just as key of dates, and these are the certifications of the levies and aids that are necessary for the system to work, for the city councils, the school boards, county boards, and so on, to make effective budgets to citizens. They do not make those in a blinded environment. They have to know what their revenues are from other sources, particularly the state aid, and what their levy authorities are. And none of the dates for these are changed in this bill. Thus, what's happening under the proposal here is the amount of time available to make both the budget decisions as well as the mechanical decisions the county auditors have to make gets to the point of being, frankly, impossible, particularly for the smaller counties that simply do not have any leeway whatsoever within their current staffing levels. I do want to point out to the committee that at the same time that the truth and taxation notices are being prepared, that the county auditor's office is also responsible for administering the elections, both the primary elections in September and all the efforts that go into the general election early in November. And then, in addition, are responsible for the collection of the second half property taxes. That's no small task, and they just simply do not have any leeway in dealing with this compressed time frame. The final thing I want to make a point to you of doing is, in last year's tax bill, that was ultimately vetoed, you did have a provision of Representative Hawes to study the truth and taxation system in terms of its cost and its participation. Although that bill was vetoed, the Department of Revenue did go through with making that survey, and I assume we'll be sharing that data with you in the near future. I ask that you keep that in mind and take a look at that information before you make any changes in the truth and taxation system. With that, I'll conclude my testimony. Be happy to answer any questions.
Are there any other testifiers from the audience? I don't see any questions. Representative Marquardt, would you make?
Yes,
Representative Demmer.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Marquardt, I just have to thank you. I had legislation, I'm sure you're aware of, that would have asked school districts to provide incentives to school districts to complete negotiations by September 1st, by the time school starts, which is roughly September 1st. And testimony, when I've had that bill forward, has the school districts and some people on behalf of schools have said that September 1st is too early to have negotiations completed because they didn't think they had enough time from the time the legislature came with their budget to know what they had to spend for salaries and that sort of thing to negotiate with. My question is, if they don't have time until September 1st to get the negotiations because they don't know how much money they have you had conversations with school districts as to whether they could certify their levy by September 1st?
Madam Chair, Representative Demmer, I have not. And just as you've heard, and what I mean, it's a very complex system. Mr. Melcher here gave me a little bit on what they do with schools. And as Mr. Carlson mentioned, there's some internal things that aren't, you know, kind of part of the official process that would have to be worked out. I mean, so I don't know.
Any closing comments? Representative Marquardt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And there was also a rep who had mentioned she's not testifying, but with the counties who also had concerns about the compression of everything. But my final comment would be that if we would move ahead with this, that we would certainly work with the counties and the cities and school districts, Department of Revenue, and in making sure this would work. There'd be somehow, I mean, there'd probably have to be some give and take on both sides with this, but there are a lot of internal things that we'd need to look at and so forth. But if we do move ahead with it, we certainly would work with those groups. But I think it is something worth pursuing, and property taxes, I think the more discussion you can have, the better, and accountability the better. But thanks so much for the committee taking the time.
House File 122 is laid over for possible inclusion in the committee report.
Thank you. Thank you, Vice Chair Brown, very much. And we're next to 2340. Representative Burns is here. And anyone care to move House File 2340? Representative Demmer moves House File 2340 for possible inclusion. Welcome and good morning, and present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I think this is pretty, it's a short bill, and I hope fairly straightforward. The goal, of course, is to have school districts save money instead of paying property taxes on some leased property. And currently there is an exemption in state law, which is you can read in the bill, and this would expand that ability to save on property taxes. What this bill does is currently a school district can have an exemption from property taxes on that leased property if the fee paid by the school district is a nominal fee or a small fee. The change in this legislation allows the school district to receive that exemption as long as the fee is less than the amount of the property taxes. In essence, you take market value for that piece of property, your rent, and you subtract the amount that would be paid for property taxes. And of course, that's the savings to the school district. There's no net revenue impact to the general fund. And with that, I'd stand for questions.
Representative Burns, and maybe, so if it's leased to school districts, then it would be exempt from property taxes? So let's say I'm a private owner and I'm paying, let's say, $10,000 of property taxes. I lease that over to a school, then I don't pay property taxes? How does that work?
Yeah, maybe. And if I understand, and I also defer to research on this too, this came, one of my local school districts has an ECFE location that they rent. And what they're looking for is to avoid paying property taxes. And it's not a nominal rent. It's not, you know, a dollar a year or whatever. It's real rent they're paying. So if you're the property owner, you don't receive a benefit to this, but the school district does. So if your rent, let's say your rent's $1,000 a month, for example, and you figure of that, I don't know what the property tax is, say $10, they have to rent the property to you for $990. And then, so the school district is not paying that $10 in property taxes as part of the lease, and you as a property owner still get the amount of market value, more or less, in rent. And I also defer to research. Hopefully I'm correct.
Yeah. Ms. Baker, is that all?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I think that this particular way of doing it might be a little bit difficult for the assessors to know exactly whether or not the school district was getting the property tax foregone. And one other option might be that the person that actually owns the property continues to pay, and then the city and the county and the school actually, or the city and county actually grant an abatement back to this educational institution, that so that they directly get that money back. Because I think what your intention here is to make sure that the school district or the ECFE or whatever, you know, group that this is, actually gets some dollars back. And I think administratively it would be very hard for the assessor to somehow work with, you know, to say what exactly is this property tax, because, you know, I just think it would put a burden on them that might be pretty difficult, and maybe an abatement might work in the same way and achieve your results.
Thank you. I know Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Burns, I like the concept. I think I was going to comment on what Ms. Baker just commented on. There's one type of a lease structure that would account for that's called a triple net lease, where basically you pay a lease and then you pay costs over and above that. And then if there was no property tax, obviously there'd be no addition to the lease. That the problem with doing that is you're specifying that they have to do a trip on that lease then, because then the property tax obviously would not be paid and it would save money, as opposed to if they didn't have a trip on that where it was included in. But that's just a thought, but I think it gets to what Ms. Baker is saying in terms of knowing for sure what's included, what isn't, what's market rate, what isn't, but that would be a thought, a triple net lease type of thing.
Any other questions for Representative Burns? Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Burns. I was actually, when I saw the bill, I was kind of wondering if this was, you know, designed for, like, charter schools that aren't allowed to buy property, and whether or not we wanted to encourage school districts to go to leasing arrangements or not. I mean, I would see for a private investor there could be some advantages to doing this, because they'd still get all the depreciation, all the tax, you know, sort of advantages of sheltering income with a client that's pretty thing. And so I kind of wasn't thinking about it in terms of a small program and a facility that might be, you know, a business program that you rented some space in a business area to operate a model business for a business education program or something like that. You know, I was thinking about it more in terms of a different context, but I do think we need to think about sort of, if you put this together, what incentives are you creating? And I know when I sat on the Government Operations Committee in the past, we found that for the state at least, it was more cost effective in the long term to own buildings rather than lease. And if that's true for schools, you know, I wouldn't want to disincentive us away from that.
Representative Brunson.
Yeah, and I absolutely hear what you're saying, Representative Loeffler. And I would, at this point, like I said, I have one school district, and they just don't have room in any of their buildings for the ECFE program. And so that's a decision they've made. And at some point, I have to hope and assume that my local school board is making the right decision on lease versus purchase, and I think they are. But that you raise a very good point. And also to Ms. Baker's point, Mr. Chair, I would absolutely pledge to work with you and get this straightened out, because we have to worry about unintended consequences, and nightmares for assessors are not a good thing. And if we can work the language to get the goal accomplished, I'd be absolutely willing to do that.
Very good. Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Burns, I'm unclear about the intent here. Would this apply whether a school rents just part of a building or part of a facility versus the whole thing?
Representative Burns?
Yeah, actually, that is the issue related to West Top School District. They rent part of, it's an old strip mall, they rent part of it. A whole bunch of the other parts of this particular building are vacant right now, but that would be the intent.
Representative Lanning?
Well, thank you. It seems to me that further complicates it when you're talking about just part of a facility. I think it would be different if you're talking about an exemption when the school rents the whole property. And, of course, then the problem you're going to run into is if you give the school district the exemption, you don't want the property owner to, in effect, pocket the tax that he or she would normally pay. So this gets complicated, it seems to me.
Is there anyone in the audience that would care to speak for or against House File 2340? Any other questions from the committee? Representative Burns, any closing arguments?
No. Thank you for your time, committee members and chair, and for giving me a hearing. And certainly a number of good points have been raised, and this bill probably can be improved as we go forward, and I certainly commit to working with everybody to do that.
Thank you very much. And just like House File 1222, it looks like there might be some room for improvement on that one. So, thank you very much. And Representative Emily News's motion to
Approves 2340 for possible inclusion into the property tax omnibus bill.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next we have Representative Broad, House File 2420, but before we do that, let's approve the minutes before we forget. We've got minutes from Friday, February 29th. Anyone care? Representative Anderson moves to approve the minutes from February 29th, 2008. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor of approving those minutes say aye. Those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. And would someone care to move House File 2412? Representative Demmer moves House File 2412 for possible inclusion. Representative Broad, thank you for being here this morning and present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I noticed that all the committee was jumping to introduce and move my bill, so I appreciate it. But, Mr. Chairman, just like the last two bills, this one is not perfect yet. But it has a good opportunity and good hope for doing some good things for property taxpayers. Let me just frame the bill a little bit in why it's here before you today. We've been dealing a lot with disasters in Minnesota's history, obviously, but this year there's been a number of them, and this bill comes forward from the situation that we faced in my communities with a tornado that came through and wiped out a number of homes. What happens in many of these cases is that the tornado comes through a rural area, takes the home which has a pretty low market value, and then when you have to replace your home, your market value then increases in a pretty significant way. So what we're trying to do is not to have those homeowners feel the shock of those increased taxes right away. What I'm trying to do is phase in that new market value over a period of 3 years. So they would pay the market value, essentially they would continue paying the market value of their home as it was and then phase in the additional market value on top of that. So again, the intent is just to kind of not create that shock of those new taxes that they would be required to pay, to phase it in a way that I think makes sense, in a way that's fair, and in a way that is absorbable by these folks who have already faced significant economic challenges through the tornadoes. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I do know that there's some discomfort with limited market values and with adjusting things in this manner. I very clearly recognize that. In addition to that, Mr. Chairman, when I say it's not perfect, I do think that we have some work to do in the language related to, you know, if you have a home that's a century home or a home that was built in 1925, market value of the structures are $90,000, and you build a huge mansion, of course, that's not what I'm looking to do in terms of limiting that market value. I'm talking about homes substantially similar to the ones that were built.
Very good. Any questions from the committee? Representative Broad, I really like this bill, and I know it, you know, has some limited market value and kind of like this old house. I thought of this damaged house rather than this old house program, but I think it's a great idea, and actually, like I said, I'm not a big fan of limited market value, but actually 3 years is pretty short. I mean, you could actually go out to 5 years and maybe phase that in, and I don't know who did the math for you here, but that was pretty good. I used the house value of $160,000 and then was damaged, and then afterwards was $200,000, which actually the gap would probably be larger. But doing the math, that $160,000 house that would have been $200,000 now after the repair would have gone the first year to $170,000, next year $180,000, next year to $190,000. So just even the formula you have in there really works out well. But I, you know, we've got a lot of damage along the Red River Valley when you have floods and stuff like that also, and I do think that you're at least keeping this person from getting a double whammy. You know, they've suffered the damage of their home, and now, you know, they fix it up, and it's really not necessarily an improvement. It's just a newer home with the same thing, and now they're going to get hit with higher property taxes after this disaster, so... I think it's a great concept you're bringing up here, and I don't know if we've got...
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
May I just frame it a little bit more, too? It's oftentimes we think of the disasters, and we focus on those in which a presidential declaration has been called. And what that does is that it excludes a significant amount of disasters that actually occur in the state that are below that threshold. So this bill does not necessarily only apply to those with the presidential declaration, but applies to those with a local declaration, which is already set forth in statute. That to me is a very important point to put on the table. The tornadoes that come through in some areas don't meet that threshold, but they certainly are equally as impactful to the families who lose their homes.
Very good. Representative Lincheski.
Thank you, Mr. Scott. I just have a question of House Research, and I don't know if Ms. Baker or Mr. Michael can remember. In the special session bill, we added Representative Howe's arson situation.
Yeah.
What did we do there? Does anyone? Was it an abatement? I can't see.
Ms. Baker?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lincheski, that is another provision. It is not the same thing as Representative Broad. It's in the local option disaster provision. And that's really singling out where counties can give an abatement if certain things happen. And like in Representative Howe's situation, when we added the arson, it was somebody had done arson of 5 or 6 homes or something, and the county wanted to give abatements and couldn't give them, and that was expanded. But that's a local option.
So in that case, Mr. Chair, it wasn't limiting market value. It was just abating the tax outright. Okay,
yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Representative Wofford, did you have a question?
Yeah, well, I was just trying to understand, and Mr. Chair and members, trying to think through kind of what is an improvement in value, because if you're just substantially replacing, you know, your roof gets blown off, and you've got some water damage, and so you tear out the sheetrock and you put on a new roof, I don't know that you've added a lot of value unless you've added a square footage, but maybe I don't know enough about the assessor practices, but I thought if you just pretty much replaced what was lost, they wouldn't add a lot more value. But your experience has been that they actually do, if it's just pretty much rebuilding what you had and repairing what you had?
Representative Broad.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Loeffler, I think it can run the gamut, to tell you the truth. In some of the situations that where the home was fully taken off, it's essentially you have just the foundation itself sitting there with the cistern that the folks were actually sitting in when the tornado went by, and why their lives were still in place. You have the home fully gone. When you have that reconstruction of a home that was built in 1890 or 1910, now you have a home that was built in 2007, you're going to have a pretty dramatic increase in value, just even if the square footages are the same, just on the basis of depreciation and things along those lines. So I think that it probably can run the gamut from having no impact if you're putting on a new roof, to having a significant amount of impact. And I think that there still does need to be, Mr. Chairman, some work done on that language to make sure that we're focusing this and targeting this in a way that we're really intending, because I think that there could be some situations like you're suggesting where there isn't that big significant swing in market value.
Representative Dietrich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Broadwin, since you're going to be relooking at the definition of disaster, I would like to suggest that you take something else into account, and it's something that I actually have had personal experience with, and that is water intrusion, mold issues. When people have those disasters to their homes, they end up rebuilding a lot of their home and sometimes having to do things that actually improve or increase the value of their home, and they never intended to do that. Because, for example, if you had a stucco home, you would not put stucco back on your home. You have to, many times, upgrade to something that you never intended to put on your home. And so that would increase the value of the home. And so if disaster would include examples like that, or are you really looking to narrow it down to natural, well, I don't know, is that a natural, man-made construction disaster? I would just like to pose that thought for you.
Representative Broad.
Mr. Chairman, and you know, I'm a little hesitant to open this up in a significant, on a huge manner, because I think that might do that. I understand the concerns,
If I recall, a couple of years ago, we actually dealt with some tax abatement or some type of market value. I'm trying to remember, looking at poor Representative Jesse as I try to remember, but it seems to me that there was some language that we discussed related to mold and water intrusion specifically in terms of giving cities the ability or counties the ability to do some things, so I'll have to look at that. I'm happy to take a look at it. I'm a little hesitant to open it up in a way that I think that would open it up pretty significantly.
Thank you.
Anyone? Representative Lincheski.
Mr. Chair, I think staff could remind everyone about mold. That's been Representative Dietrich worked on that, and mm-hmm. Representative Goodwin, I think, mm-hmm. before, and mm-hmm. Representative Broad is right. There's been a lot of debate about mold for a long time. I don't know that the folks who feel there's a problem feel that problem has yet been resolved in Minnesota statute, but maybe Ms. Baker can recall what actually of all the proposals that have been out there got done in the world of mold.
Mr. Chairman, just as a side note, whatever has been done, we have been recommended not to take that route because it's more harmful.
Well, you know, as I look at this too, you know, you're looking at this home, let's say, that was built in the 1890s that is taken off of its foundation, and certainly that they wouldn't build the same type of house, but what you could figure out somehow is, in this, write this in the language, where the assessor would have to calculate, if you were to rebuild that type of house today, what would be the value? Because you'd probably, it'd probably be bigger, or whatever it might be, and then that would kind of be the base or anything extra, you know, so you kind of have this base difference, and you know, if you add it on, that part of course would be new because you've added on and so, but I know that could be worked out, but I personally like the concept here because people do tend to get that double whammy when they, if they do, and in that case it's going to cost them a lot more and that value of that home is going to go up, and so I don't know, it might be the best bill we've heard today.
Mr. Chairman, I know that the truth in taxation process has been a frustrating and important reform item for both this committee and the state. So, Mr. Chairman, I really, really appreciate your efforts on truth in taxation. I think that's definitely an area that I'd like to see reformed in addition to the importance of my bill.
Very good. Any other comments, Representative Demmer?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just question, last year in the tax bill, you know, when we were talking about the excluding ag land, and then we included a provision that would have actually been a bill back to the state by the county for a portion as opposed to doing a valuation difference or whatever. It was Representative Shumpert's bill. Remember we took 80% of the ag value and that was actually billed to the state by the counties and then the state would pay that difference and then the taxpayer would save that.
Representative Demmer, is that on the school equalization on the debt service?
Well, it had to do with ag land for the purpose of capital debt levy.
Yes, okay.
And I had the bill that would exclude the property and then I think we took Representative Shumpert's idea where you took 80% of the ag portion and the counties were going to bill the state for that and then the ag land owner would not have to pay that portion.
And I think it wound up 36%. It was
whatever the percentage was. I'm talking about the concept here where the county was billing for a portion as opposed to changing market values.
Oh, okay.
And I'm wondering if there's any other, would that be the first time that we have counties billing the state for a difference like that when we're not really monkeying with market values, we're just working with the tax itself. And the reason I'm getting to the question is because as opposed to horsing around with the market values, the same concept would be tracking this, and I don't know how the auditors or assessors feel about this, possibly look at doing the same concept where the difference in the value generates a tax difference, where we'd bill the state back for that tax difference as opposed to changing the market value. And I'm talking conceptually here. In other words, if the first time that counties billed the state for something was last year in the tax bill, then there's probably not a mechanism for doing that. If, on the other hand, we have the places to do that, this would be one more item on the list then to build the state for if we did it that way as opposed to changing the market values. I don't know if this is making sense, but are you with me?
Representative Broad, any comments to that?
Mr. Chairman, that seems like there could be a mechanism similar to almost like the market value credit, which is a pass-through. Maybe I'm not understanding your question, but it seems like there could be a mechanism that would do that. Obviously, there would be some different impacts to the state budget in doing that. But, you know, I think that relating it to back to the mold discussion, which I'm loosely recalling, you know, it just seems to me that there was some discussion related to shifts in the local communities and things along those lines, and I'm happy to talk about all of those things. I think it would be difficult to set up a new mechanism transferring money back and forth, but I'm not opposed to doing that per se. I'm just not sure. I certainly would be happy to work with House Research on finding out if there's already a mechanism in place, and if so, does it make sense? I think with the budget situation the way it is, it's probably a more difficult road to take.
Yes, and Ms. Baker, Mr. Michael, is there anything, did you find anything that is worth sharing for the committee this morning?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we did find the valuation reduction for homestead property damaged by mold, and one of the real differences is it's just a one-year thing, and what it does is it says you have to have at least a $20,000 estimated cost, and the county can grant a reduction in the market value equal to that estimated cost to cure the condition, and they have to apply for it, and then it's a reduction for 1 year. I have no idea how much it's been used. I haven't really ever talked to assessors, and I see we have somebody from Dakota County. Maybe they can say whether or not, like in Dakota County, they've ever used it. But I haven't heard of, you know, how much it was used. But this was Representative Goodwin-Bill.
Representative Broad.
I do know that the assessors are here and have some concerns over the limited market value nature of the bill, and I would guess that they would probably be, they can speak for themselves, but I guess they would probably be more inclined to like the direction that Representative Demmer is going, so that there's not a limited market value situation, but they can speak for themselves.
Why don't we at this time hear any testimony from the audience, for or against?
Go ahead,
Representative Demmer.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm not really advocating. I'm just throwing it out for discussion. You know, as we've talked about, not changing the values, but looking at whether it's class rates or whether it's rebates or whether it's whatever. It seems like it's another moving part, and we're kind of tiptoeing back into, wading back into changing valuations as opposed to working with class rates and or some other mechanism for actually. So that was the only purpose of my thought. It was just to kind of for discussion. I'm not necessarily advocating yet because I think there's obviously other consequences in terms of who ultimately ends up paying the difference that's there. So anyway, just a thought.
Pretty good. Please state your name.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Gloria Pinky. I'm a manager in Dakota County Assessor's Office, but I'm also a member of the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers Legislative Committee, and that's why I'm here today. Our Association of Minnesota Assessors has in our position statement, and I'd like to read just this one provision. MAAO believes adjustments to market values, such as limitations on assessors' estimated market values, acquisition values, or deferments or exemptions, create the inequities between taxpayers. So that's the premise, that we typically do not think limited market value is a way to go. I do want to comment, though, on this specific bill that I understand and really appreciate the goal of this bill. We've been very fortunate in Dakota County where we haven't had any major disasters. So I don't have personal knowledge of tornadoes or the floods that Representative Landingsbury or Southeast Minnesota Representative Demers may have gone through. I do know it's very stressful for families, communities, and assessors as well in trying to administer even the current disaster laws that are in place. This bill, as I think I understand it, would be in addition to the current laws that relate to presidential disasters. I don't know that it's replacing it, so I'm just not quite sure on how that would work. If it's another tool to administer and follow and track and so on, so that would be something that I'd need to get better informed on. Also, it seems like whenever there's limited market values or somebody's not paying, if we put a limited market value on a certain segment of the property, other taxpayers pick it up typically, unless there's going to be some provision to not have that shifted to other taxpayers. And I would also just call it to your attention that this is homes only, and that's typically where we hear and feel and hurt for those people that are have their homes destroyed or damaged. But businesses can also be severely impacted, as we heard often in southeast Minnesota, where their businesses were flooded and they had to start over. So this, the bill, as I understand it right now, would not do anything for those properties, so they evidently would not be covered. I'm just calling that to your attention. I don't know what the policymakers would choose to do with that. Mm-hmm. As the bill is currently written, I did notice that the effective date is January of 2007. I don't know if that would be changed or not, but I'm not sure how my colleagues in Southeast Minnesota would like adding this to what they've already gone through. So just offering that for consideration as well, that I know Southeast Minnesota assessors have worked very, very hard to administer the special session legislation that was passed, and if they now have to go back and do something all over again, or in addition, that could be very stressful on their bookkeeping and administration. So I think it's a good concept, and I certainly understand the emotions that go with this, but it is difficult to administer, so we can do it, but keep in mind some of those things. Ms. Baker mentioned about mold, and I'll just make some comments. We use the mold abatement process quite extensively in Dakota County when we become aware of them. I don't have a number because I didn't know that was going to come up, but we could certainly provide that. But we do mold abatements, and we get we need the information from the property owner on how much the cost to cure is, and so that has been working, as far as I know, quite well in Dakota County. We've not heard of any big complaints, not to say there aren't any, but we have not heard of them. And I'll stand for questions.
Thank you very much for your time. Any questions for Ms. Pinky? Thank you very much. And I also have to say, on House File 1222, my effective dates also would have to be moved back all a year, and I forgot to mention that. So with these bills that were introduced last year, so I think we would work with that. Any other comments to House File 2412? Not Representative Broad, thank you. We had good discussion on this, and we'll renew the Denver motion for House File 2412 to be for possible inclusion into a property tax bill.
Mr. Chairman, I appreciate that you came from a possible inclusion from a possible property tax bill to a possible inclusion in a property tax bill.
I'm getting more optimistic as the meeting goes on. Thank you very much. Any other comments for the good of the order? If not, everyone have a very nice weekend, and thank you. We're adjourned.